So I would like to thank François and Jeff and Gustavo for inviting me. It's always a pleasure to visit. And the first thing I need to do is to acknowledge the contribution of my student, Jay Lim, that is doing his dissertation on this topic. So we are going to switch gears a little bit compared to the previous talks, and we are going to go all the way to Shannon. And Shannon introduced back in 48 the notions of capacity and entropy, and with them he ignited the revolution in communications. Then these are basic concepts that tell us that the amount of information that a waveform can transport scales with the bandwidth, and logarithmically equal the signal-to-noise ratio. These formulas are engraved not only in our minds, but they are actually physically engraved in the various portraits of Shannon that adorn the United States, various sites of the United States. So the title of this talk is saying is actually asking a question, and the question is whether we can construct analogous notions of capacity and entropy in a deterministic setting. As you know, Shannon's theory is based on probability, and this is a workshop on stochastic geometry. So we won't have much probability here, but we will have notions of geometry throughout the talk. So I hope that I'll keep your interest going in that way. So why do we go to a deterministic model? Why deterministic? Well, the thing is that when you look at information theory in the broadest context of systems, where there are different disciplines that converge, you will see that in fields like control theory, for example, the usage of deterministic model has been advocated several times. The control theorists like to use models where the disturbance of the system is bounded, unknown but bounded, and do not like too much to put a probability distribution on it. As well, in electromagnetics, our group has advocated in the last few years that usage of deterministic models can lead, for example, to the determination of the number of channels that you can have between a set of users and another set of users that are physically separated in space. And this number of channels follows from electromagnetic wave theory and can give us guidelines of whether different stochastic fading models can be applicable or not. So there is some interest, and actually yesterday talking to Venkat, he was telling me that also in coding theory there is interest of constructing codes without an underlying probability space. So what do we do then? Well, we go to the deterministic setting, and we invoke, as it was previously said, the shadow of Kolmogorov. And if we look back in history, when Shannon came out with his paper in 1948, Kolmogorov actually read his paper in the early 50s, and he was very much impressed by Shannon's ideas. He immediately recognized the importance of Shannon's work, and most probably influenced by Shannon's work, he introduced notions, analogous notions of entropy and capacity in a deterministic setting, and in a deterministic setting of functional approximation. And these concepts have evolved. They found their own path into the mathematical theory of analysis. Of course, there are connections between the concept of capacity of entropy of Kolmogorov and the concept of capacity entropy of Shannon. And Kolmogorov himself pointed out some of this connection in a famous presentation that he gave at the International Symposium on Information Theory, as well as in a big review paper that he published with Tikhomirov. In an appendix, but as in his own words, he limited the analogy, the discussion at the level of analogy and parallelism without going into the deep details of how these two models were related. And perhaps the reason for that is that at the time he was doing that, the theory of spectral concentration of band-limited functions was not yet fully developed by Landau, Pollack, and Slepian, so their work came later. And that is a critical step that you need to draw a full parallelism between the two. So you need to know how signals can be concentrated in time and frequency. So you needed that kind of theory. The connection between entropies is a little bit better understood than the connection between capacities. And in fact, there are several papers, among which there is a review by Donohoe that is available on the web that explains how number of entropy is related to the rate distortion function in information theory. This is a little bit more understood. And as I will show, we'll make some more connections and improvements there. So let me start with the capacity then. So we will have Kolmogorov on the left side and Shannon on the right side. How does this work? So let's look at the deterministic model first. So we're going to look at waveforms, F, that are functions of a variable that will be time. And they are have finite energy, so they are square integrable functions of some sort. They have an energy constraint. And they are band limited, so their Fourier transform has a finite support. Omega, angular frequency, capital omega, between plus omega and minus omega. Then there is this notion of number of degrees of freedom, and this is where the Slepian and Pollock and Landau theory plays a big role. So basically we can define a number and zero that is the product of omega t over pi, where t is the observation interval where you observe the waveform at the receiver. And this gives you the number of degrees of freedom that is basically the number of basis functions that can represent the signal up to arbitrary accuracy. So there is an orthonormal approximating space that can represent the function up to arbitrary accuracy as t grows. Now, if you have that, then you identify any waveform with this number of coordinates in a well-defined approximation theoretic sense. So every waveform corresponds to a point in the space. And to the waveform, you add a perturbation, epsilon, so you're not able to observe the waveform precisely, but because of noise, you have an uncertainty in the observation of this point in the high-dimensional space of dimension n0. And for Kolmogorov, the perturbation is a fixed constant epsilon, so you have this region of uncertainty, and therefore the signal-to-noise ratio is the energy E divided by epsilon squared. Okay. Shannon has a similar model. He also looks at finite energy functions, and they observe over minus t over 2 and t over 2, and this has the additional constraint that the energy over this interval should scale with the number of dimensions, and you will see in a moment why that is needed. So in this case, the energy actually grows with the number of dimensions. The average power is finite. Functions are band-limited, and the number of degrees of freedom is as before. But now what Shannon does, he adds a Gaussian random variable that is the perturbation on each dimension. So in each dimension you add an uncertainty, a Gaussian random variable standard deviation square root of n. Okay. So if you do that, you're going to observe the waveform with some random perturbation, and the perturbation actually scales with the number of dimensions. So that is the main reason why you need to scale the energy with the number of dimensions. And the signal-to-noise ratio is Pn0 divided by n0n, so it's P over n in this case. Okay? So very similar. The main point is that this is a soft sphere because it's governed by probability distribution. This is a hard sphere that is in Kolmogorov case. Then we have... Yeah?
So could you come back to the... So the Gaussian is, you would have per dimension.
No? Per dimension, you add a random variable.
And so if you would compare to the viewpoint on the left, so the per dimension has vanished here.
It's vanished, yeah. That's why this is constant.
Mm-hmm.
So, but if you rescale the space, it's going to be the same. In fact, that's, you know, if you rescale the space, the signal-to-noise ratio is the same into the two cases, because in one case, you're blowing up also the energy as well as the noise. Then we need a notion of distances between functions, between points, that if two points are separated enough, then we are going to be able to distinguish between them. And the distance that we use is L2, so it's in L2 distance between functions. And basically, if two functions are two functions and two points in this space are separated enough, they will be distinguishable according to Kolmogorov, provided that their distance is greater than 2 epsilon, because you can just see them as different objects. In Shannon's case, since these are soft spheres, there will always be some overlap, some probability that you cannot distinguish the two. So what Shannon says is that the two are distinguishable with high probability if the region of overlap is not too large. So these noise spheres will concentrate around the standard deviation, and therefore, with high probability, you are going to be able to distinguish the signals if you are within a standard deviation distance between the two. So then what is capacity then? Capacity becomes sphere packing. You have to count how many of these spheres you can put in your signal space in such a way that you can distinguish signals at the receiver. And then you measure this number in bits by taking the logarithm. So capacity, in Kolmogorov case, you define the maximum number of points, distinguishable points in the space. That is the number of spheres of radius epsilon that you can pack in this space of radius E, or square root of E, without overlap. And the 2 epsilon capacity, you take the log of that, and that is the number of bits that that correspond to transmitting the signal. Then you can also talk about capacity per unit time by dividing by T and do this by bits per second and take it to the limit. Shannon is similar. However, as we said, we have soft spheres, so you have the maximum number of points that you can pack in the space such that the probability that you can distinguish between any, we cannot distinguish between any two of them is smaller than a probability of error. Okay, so now it depends on the probability of error. So the probability of error is less than PE rather than being completely distinguishable. And similarly, you can talk about capacity for that probability of error measured in bits. But then the remarkable thing in Shannon's paper is that when you take per unit time, when you take this limit, now the capacity itself does not depend on P anymore, because the dependence on P is over here, and when you take T go to infinity, the dependence of P vanishes, and you have a capacity that is bits per second with the PE that can be as small as you want. As long as it is constant, you can have as small as you want, and that capacity does not depend on the probability of error anymore. You have the comment?
The question is
that,
why is
part
of
that?
Say that again?
The zero error capacity. So I'm going to... if you wait a few slides, we'll get to that. Very, very good observation. So this is actually more similar to zero error capacity than Shannon capacity. But we'll see that in a moment.
So this is the Gaussian case on the... there an analog because spheres are maximum likelihood in the Gaussian case. So what is the analog of the non-Gaussian case for the Kolmogorov setting?
I haven't looked at that, but basically, you know, the Gaussian case is is very nice. It goes to a sphere, but actually, something very interesting. You could take, you know, these shapes, and you can also change the depending on how do you model the noise. The shape can change. So, for example, when you are at high dimensions, you might squeeze this sphere a little bit, so there are many things that you can play with that one can think of. Okay. So let's compare now. So it seems, at least at the intuitive level, that the two models of Shannon and Kolmogorov are driven by the same geometric intuition, and the geometric intuition is that you want to pack the space with balls. And not only that, they also have the same operational significance in terms of reliable communication with noise perturbed signals. So they're really going after the same thing, one in a deterministic way or another in the stochastic setting. So really they're playing the same game of packing billiard balls in high-dimensional space, and they are keeping the score in bits. That's what they are doing. They are playing this game and see how many you can plug in and give the result in bits. So if that is the game, what's the score? So let's see what the score is. And Shannon scores a big goal just at the beginning because he has a beautiful formula that is tight. So actually he has a complete solution and says that the capacity, as we all know, is bandwidth log 1 plus SNR. So the reason why it is divided by pi is because it's angular frequency. So it's omega over pi log of square root 1 plus SNR. And the upper bound and lower bounds match. Kolmogorov defense is lacking. Kolmogorov defense is lacking, and in fact, the bounds that we have for the 2 epsilon capacity per unit time are quite loose. We have an upper bound that sort of resembles Shannon, but the lower bound can be as small as zero, so that's not very informative. And these were given by some papers of Jagerman back in the 70s. So why is that? What goes wrong with Jagerman results? So if you look at Jagerman's proof, he needs to construct a packing for the lower bound. And what he does, he does a very simple packing. And the simple packing that he does is he constructs a box inside the sphere, and he just packs the box like that. Yes, a little bit in high dimensions. So both the volume of the square and the volume of the ball both tends to zero in a high dimension when you have a fixed energy constraint. But what happens is that the volume of the square vanishes at a much faster rate than the volume of the ball. So for that reason, most of the mass here, most of the volume escapes on the boundary of this ball, and therefore these spheres are covering nothing eventually in high dimensions. So most of the action is out here and the packing is inside. And so in fact you can actually do a back of the envelope calculation very quickly. You see that the number of balls here is given by 1 plus the sides of this, the length of the box, side length divided by the diameter of the sphere. And the side length actually in high dimension is E over 2 becomes E over N0. And therefore, this is 1 plus square root of SNR. When you take the logarithm, you get N0 times the logarithm of that. And when N0 is very large, you expand the logarithm using Taylor, and you see that the capacity scales only with the square root of N0. So the capacity per unit degrees of freedom per unit time is only greater than 0. So it's not good packing for high dimensions. Upper bound, what Jagerman does, he uses. I knew that something was going to go wrong with the equation switching computer. All right. So what he does, he uses basic inequality that goes back to Kolmogorov that says that 2 epsilon capacity is upper bounded by epsilon entropy. The epsilon entropy, rather than packing, is covering. So it's the minimum number of balls that cover the space. And so you can find an upper bound on the epsilon entropy to get an upper bound on capacity. That's the standard strategy. So the first thing that we do is we basically have we coach a little bit Kolmogorov defense, and we are scoring also some points. So we can make not as good as Shannon, but closer. And we have tighter bounds. One thing about these bounds that you, in order to evaluate what's going on, if you take at high SNR, then at high SNR, what happens is that you are basically within half a bandwidth of each other. So you're within omega over 2 pi, so half a bandwidth slack between the two. But the most important thing is that now both of them have the same functional form, which actually means that the capacity scales linearly with the bandwidth and logarithmically with the scenario. We can conclude that from these bounds. And this is really cool, I think, because it shows that the fact that you go logarithmically with the scenario and linearly with bandwidth is a basic property of information that is independent on the details of the model. Either it's probabilistic or deterministic, we don't care, is really the result that we have. So it's kind of nice. And the way we do that, we do not do an explicit code book. We have an existential proof, and we rely on geometric properties of covering and packing. So you have to use the results, the techniques for covering and packing in geometry. Okay, so if that is the result, is that a timeout? Is the game over? So is this the end of the game? Is that as much as we can say? But actually, there is a penalty kick at the last minute, and and we have the referee asking a question. So when we, and this is related to the question that you asked just a few minutes ago. So when we presented this result the first time, so Francois was talking to me and they're asking, okay, but then what is an error exponent? What is the notion of error in a deterministic setting? You don't have a notion of error. And over the years, I learned that when Francois says something, you should think about it carefully. So we go back home and we do a little bit more homework, and then we revisit the model. So basically what I talked so far in this deterministic model, signals are distinguishable with no error, and it turns out that this is related to the zero error capacity, so the capacity with zero error that Shannon also studied. If we want to relate a deterministic model to Shannon capacity where you have a probability of error, you have to change the model a little bit. And so we did that, and we proposed a notion of epsilon delta capacity. So how do we do that? We allow for a certain amount of overlap in the packing of the bolts, so that the signals are epsilon delta distinguishable. This is not really distinguishable, but that's what is written there. It's epsilon delta distinguishable if the portion of space where the total overlap is, the portion of space where you cannot distinguish this capital delta, is resulting in a decoding error, is at most little delta. Okay, so just like before, the probability of error should be less than PE. Now we have the amount of overlap, the fraction of space where you overlap, and you can make an error, should be less than delta, basically. And now what we do, we define the packing as the maximum number of points that you can put in your signal space such that the overlap region is less than delta. And the epsilon delta capacity, we say that is the logarithm of that number. Okay? And then we take the epsilon delta capacity per unit time, and we hope also that in our case this will be independent on delta, so you can take your delta as small as you want in an asymptotic sense. This is completely parallel to Shannon, that says that the probability of error should be less than PE, and capacity depends on PE when you measure in bits, but when you take the limit, it does not depend on PE. Okay, you can take the probability of error as small as you want. So with that, we actually are very close to Shannon. So with that, we have bounds that are within one unit of each other, of the epsilon delta capacity per unit time, and they are tight in a higher scenario. The one vanishes. So it's basically also in this case, it's important that as in Shannon's case, the capacity per unit time, these bounds, they do not depend on the size of the error region. When I take the limit for t go to infinity, the dependence on the delta, which is a constant divided by t, in my equation will vanish, and therefore you have nice formulas. If I give you the formula in bits, it's much more messy than this. But in bits per unit time is nice and tight. So with that, we can also talk about error exponents now. So to make Francois happy, we can have a number of messages in the code book to be 2 to the TR, where R is the rate, and R is chosen smaller than the upper bound on capacity. Okay, you choose R smaller than the upper bound on capacity, and you can prove that the size of the error region, in this case, is at most 2 to the minus T, this constant here, that works as error exponent. So basically, the size of the error region decays as 2 to the this constant T exponentially. So the error exponent is basically this constant that depends only on the bandwidth, on the signal-to-noise ratio, and on the rate. And it's the same as in Shannon's case. So we have that as well. Now, the final thing is for entropy. I talked about capacity a lot. I want to just say a few things about entropy. As I said, entropy, the connection was a little bit more developed. And we know that entropy in the deterministic setting is precisely the rate distortion function in Shannon's case. This has been noticed many times in the literature. So let me just review that. So what is Kolmogorov entropy is the minimum number of bits that can represent any signal with a given error constraint. So basically you take these spheres of the size epsilon and you cover the space. And now if you cover everything, it means that any point that you have, you can approximate, you can represent with F hat, this is the center of one of these spheres. And therefore, every point can be represented by as a center of a sphere with an error at most epsilon of norm epsilon or energy epsilon square. So, therefore, this corresponds. If you take the logarithm of this number, it corresponds to the minimum number of bits that can represent any signal with that error. Okay, so it's a representation kind of thing. For Shannon entropy, if you look in Cover and Thomas, for example, you take a stochastic process, you quantize it at each dimension of the space is quantized at a level epsilon, you discretize that in that way, and now the average number of bits that represent this quantized stochastic process is Shannon's entropy. Of course, when you do that, you do not really need to quantize each dimension at the same level, but you could also have more generally a quantizer. It's a set of points here in the space, and this is your quantizer, and then you assign the function to the center closer to it, making a mean square error that is f of t minus f hat squared, the average of that. Okay, if your stochastic process is f. In that case, the minimum number of bits per second that can represent the process with a given accuracy is the rate distortion function. Okay, so I'm going fast because this is sort of known in information theory. Therefore, the entropy in Shannon's case, you have a stochastic process that has infinite energy but finite average power, and you have a constraint on the error in the representation, that is a sigma square n0, and the rate distortion function is the logarithm of the number of bits that are required to represent the process with this error constraint, and divided by t and take the limit. Okay. Same for Kolmogorov, you have an energy constraint, you have a representation error constraint, and h epsilon is the number of both, so it's in bits, and when you take epsilon entropy per unit time, you get the analogous of the rate distortion function, that is the entropy per unit time. Okay, so these are two analogous things. So given these definitions, how are we doing for when we compute this for band-limited signals? So how are we doing when we compute the entropy of Shannon for functions that are in L2? And for that, we have a draw basically, and for that we have that the entropy is again scaling logarithmically with SNR and linearly with the bandwidth as it should be, and this is Shannon's formula for the rate distortion function of the Gaussian process. They are exactly the same, and this again improves on some of previous bounds of Jagerman that were not tight. So they are the same as they should be. So with that, I finish my presentation, and I think that at the end we can call it a draw.
Questions? Is anything known for an explicit code book better than the Jagerman?
No, I do not know how to construct a code book. Existential proof, yeah.
I guess mine is a more sort of high level question.
But in coding, you know, they do these deterministic constructions. I'm not an expert in that. It might be related to what people are looking at coding, but usually they're not working with continuous spaces. So, but for this setting, no. Yeah.
So in this setting and many other things, it looks like the intuition is for large-scale systems, things concentrate.
Yeah.
So deterministic intuition or some sort of concentrations. There is no fundamental, probabilistic system doesn't give you any fundamental new insight into the system.
Well, there are two concentrations, right? So there is a concentration in dimensionality that both Shannon and the deterministic model have, and that is what we are using. So dimensionality concentrates around this N0. And Shannon, on top of that, in Shannon model, you have a probabilistic concentration, that is that the noise concentrates around the entropy.
Okay.
So we get rid of that, basically, the second concentration.
What I'm trying to ask is, so there's this notion of typicality or concentration, either time or space or some sort of concentration.
Yeah.
Once you account for that, it's sort of a deterministic analysis is what many of these high-dimensional probabilistic things come to, which is sort of deterministic. I'm curious, beyond this, is there anything sort of fundamentally in probabilistic systems that gives you first-order intuition which is different? One example I can think of is a PK formula in QA, which is sort of how variance fundamentally changes things. So it's not exactly a new system, but I'm just asking broadly, will probability give you counterintuitive things from deterministic systems in any other than this example?
Yeah, as you pointed out, things work smoothly here because we are taking limits. If you look at the results before taking limit, they are not as clean. You need a construction. The construction is very hairy, and you get these formula in bits that are not as nice. But that is also the case in Shannon. I mean, the reason why Shannon formula works is because at the end you take the limit, and you have the probability of error that vanishes. So, you know, there is the work of Yuri Polyansky that is looking at what happens when you do not take this limit and you have a finite block length regime. And doing that also in a deterministic setting would be a headache.
You could work out the same kind of packing. Finally, you could think of it as a packing problem.
Yeah, very difficult problems. I mean,
yes, I understand the combinatorics of that in high dimensional ball packing is really messy.
Right.
But.
Yeah. Francois, do you want to have the last word?
What type of what sphere packing result do you use to get this the result that you?
Two things. One is that we don't really use a particular result. We do use a technique that is outlined in the book by Sloan. We use that technique. One of our results can also be derived, and we explained that in the paper, it can be derived using a previous result of Pinsker, but you need to do quite a bit of work from his theorem to get to our results. You have to do a messy computation, but we provide a shorter proof, a nice short proof for that. So some things, you know, you can do with previous things. I do not know if our search was exhaustive, but we looked at all possible tools that we could use. Maybe there are others to do things simpler. I'm not sure. Yeah.
Maybe we can suggest we take remaining questions offline. I have a break now. So thank you very much.